going to step out from Hebrews today. The book of Job. Paul, the apostle, makes a very interesting statement in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 in describing the difficulties, the trials. He said this, he said, "The sentence of death is upon us." Of course, he was referring to the reality that they didn't know in whatever city they went into if it was life or death. And so he said, "Sentence of death is upon us." I'm thankful for the ministry of Grace Baptist Church, and I'm thankful for the ministry that God has allowed me and you have tolerated for the past, some of you for the past 17 years. In this season, I feel like the sentence of death is upon us. I don't know why. But this, in the last 6 months, there's been at least 10 different individuals from within our church or close relatives of those who are members of our church who have died. Ranging everything from what we might consider normal homegoings to cancer to elderly to young to suicide. What do we do with this? As Christians, what do we do? I do encourage you to come to the funeral this afternoon, even if you didn't know Ben well. Not just to support the Manukians, though that's very important, in the Artunian family. As you notice that they're not here with us today, and that's a pretty big hole in our church attendance when their family's not here. And I think that symbolizes the hole in our hearts and the hole they feel. But one of the reasons I encourage you is that really this is a two-part sermon today. I want to look at Job, the book of Job today, and then the funeral I'm going to be preaching again from the book of Lamentations and the hope that God gives in the midst of suffering and weeping. As I said, I don't know why God has chosen at this time for our church to not only face many feelings of the sentence of death, of seems like it's just happening a lot, but more than that, difficult diagnoses, broken families, marriages in turmoil. As I said, I've been ministering here for 17 years. We've gone through many different things, but I sense that we are facing as a family. We're facing supernatural attack. When Satan seeks to bring suffering, he doesn't intend, it's not his purpose, to cause us pain. I'm not saying he wants something other than pain for us. What I'm saying is that Satan doesn't care about our happiness or pain. He doesn't just want to make us feel bad. He doesn't care if we feel good or bad. He wants to destroy our faith. Satan's attacks are meant to destroy faith, to destroy trust. Amazingly, our sovereign God has determined that those very attacks by Satan will be that which will build faith in his people. And that's what we find in the book of Job. Job is one of the Hebrew wisdom literature books. I know this sounds crazy, but in our shortened sermon today, I'm planning to preach all 42 chapters. We will do it because I'm going to ask you to take notes, to pay attention, then to go back and read it. We're not going to read the book today. That would take more than our time allotted just to read it. But I'm going to give an overview of the book of Job. I'm going to be quoting some scriptures from out it, pulling some here and there, just to give you kind of a sense of what's going on. We won't be able to examine all of it for sure. to give us a place to set our moorings as we think of God's word here. One of the wisdom literature books, poetic books, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job, Song of Songs, and Psalms are wisdom books. Three wisdom books go together. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job. Proverbs, general wisdom principles showing that God is wise and just in how he has ordered the universe. If you read Proverbs, you recognize the fool, the lazy man, violent people receive their due, while the wise, diligent, and good receive their reward. Generally speaking, in Proverbs, God's ordered the universe that you get what you deserve. And then Ecclesiastes comes into the picture. And the preacher, as he's called in Ecclesiastes, says, actually, it feels like you don't always get what you deserve. And it seems like the wicked receive blessing and the righteous do not. And then sometimes the righteous receive blessings and the wicked do not. And it sometimes seems like there's a meaningless to it. We can't understand it. Much of the life is good and bad and is essentially mysterious to us who live under the sun. Obviously, there's more to Ecclesiastes than that, but we're not preaching that today. The preacher in Ecclesiastes suggests that all we can really do, and he's right in this, is fear God and keep his commandments. This is the duty of man in this seeming mysterious nature, navigating pain and pleasure. And then Job. Job, a real experience of a real man navigating the tensions of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. The storyline of Job is essentially this. A good man experiences very bad things. Intense pain and suffering. He cannot make sense of it. And he cries out in desperation and pain. His three friends try to make sense of it by falling back on the wisdom of Proverbs. I mean, God has ordered the universe in a way in which the just get justice and the wicked get rewards for their, they get judgment. So you must have done something to deserve this punishment, this judgment. This man, Job, doesn't understand it all, but he knows that's just not the case in this situation. And so he takes the position of Ecclesiastes. It's just too mysterious. I don't know much, but I know I didn't do anything to deserve this. And he tries to fall back on that. A mysterious fourth person enters the dialogue, the debate. And he says essentially this, well, you're both right and you're both wrong. Finally, in the book of Job, God has the final word. But it's not what anyone would expect. There's a twist in the story. I want to jump into Job. It begins this way. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. A good man who fears God, quite religious in the best sense of the word, loves his family, wise with the resources God had given him, a diligent soul, a prominent individual in a fairly large community, he was the quintessential Proverbs man, the wise man, the good man. Our story starts out pretty normal, speaking of this Proverbs man, Job. But then we enter a world, the author brings us into a world that we know very little about. The unseen world, the immaterial world. Our story starts out pretty normal, but the book suddenly shifts beyond what we can see to what we cannot see, the world of angels and demons. A very real world indeed, only invisible and silent to our ears. God has made both the seen world in which we live and the unseen world in which we cannot really comprehend. He has made both under his authority and with his touch of divine beauty in their own way. But beings in both worlds rebelled against God. And beings in both worlds suffered God's judgment, a curse, in their rebellion. We, being descendants of the material world, of that rebel, Adam, suffer the effects of that curse. And the other one is known in biblical literature as Satan. He is the being in the spiritual world who also rebelled against God, and those who followed him suffer a curse as well. Obviously, today we're not going to go exploring the full ramifications of the unseen world, but the story in Job tells us that something was happening simultaneously in the unseen world, in the supernatural world, while things were happening in the natural world. And that's verses 6 on down. We find out something is going on. What is it? I don't fully understand. I don't think we're meant to fully comprehend what's happening. Essentially, these sons of God, or angelic beings, as they're called, come before God. They're still under his authority. And among them is this rebel, this Satan. This, really, the word means opposer. And God calls all the beings in the spiritual world to see the faithfulness of this man Job in the physical world. Satan, as he does and he has ever since the fall of man, opposes God, opposes man, disbelieves God, doubts him, and doubts Job. He essentially tells God, the only reason that Job is a good man is because you've given him good things. He essentially accuses God of setting up props with Job. Knock out the props and he'll fall just like everyone else. The reason why Satan thinks this way is that's exactly who he is. God knows that is not the case. And so in a mysterious way, God allows Satan to knock out the props. Verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth, walking back and forth on it. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? So Satan answered, and the Lord said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So this is exactly what happens. Everything that Job had gained through his diligent, virtuous life is taken from him. His children, his possessions, and not just taken from him in some genteel way, but violently ripped from him. Assassins and robbers and storms and tragedies. And the opposer opposes God and Job and brings pain and suffering. But somehow, Job proves God right. In verse 20, then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshiped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin, nor charge God with wrong. Well, because of this, chapter 2 plays the second track of this record. And in chapter 2, Satan is allowed to take Job's health. You ever heard people say that when you're going through great tragedy? Well, at least you have your health. Well, he couldn't say that anymore. Job has lost everything, and now he loses his health. And to top it all off, his companion, the wife of his youth, a sub-theme throughout the wisdom literature, comes to him and says, just curse God and die. Later on, Job will actually say about his wife, "My breath is a stench in her nostrils." Meaning his wife turns and blames him for it all. After all, Proverbs, right? You must have done something. What secret sins do you have? So he loses everything, his health, and now his wife. At the end of chapter 2, we find this. Verse 11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite, for they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted up their voices and wept. And each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. Can I jump out of the story for just a moment? As a pastor, and do two things. One, to encourage you as a church through this season of fire for the past 6 months, I have experienced a maturity and a growth amongst this assembly of comforting one another, of walking through pain with one another, stepping in and caring for one another. Might I also encourage you, keep doing that. Do what Job's friends did at first. They sat down with him, companionship, and on the ground, empathy. They went where he was at and they did what he did. They put dust on their head. He had dust on his head. That's how you mourn with people. That's how you mourn biblically with people. Do not debate theology amidst deep sorrow. Do not tell them, "I know what you're going through," because you don't. It's a lie. Don't tell them about your grief. It's not about you. Don't offer platitudes. It will all work out in the end. Just keep smiling. Don't worry. Be happy. Now, God has a plan, you know. Sit down, put dust on your head, and weep. That's how you mourn with people. And I thank you as a church. That's what you've done. End my little side note. Just jump back in the story. Chapter 3 is then hauntingly beautiful poetry. Read this chapter. It's Job questioning, complaining, protesting, weeping. In chapter 3, Job says things that probably we shouldn't say. And yet God never once chides him for saying those things. God gives us permission to be confused in suffering, to mourn, to weep, to call out why. He gives us permission to that. And Job does in chapter 3. He calls out, listen to some of the things he says in the poetry of it. "May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said, a male child is conceived. Why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breasts that I should nurse? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, and whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes before the Lord, and my groanings pour over like water." Now, the story shifts from Job's protest. And it really, the bulk of the book of Job, 4 through 31, chapter 4 through chapter 31, is really one big section. Now, good Hebrew poetry always does things in threes. Three sections, and it's very parallel. Chapters 4 through 14, his friends Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar argue with Job. Then 15 through 21, in the same order, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar contend again with Job. And then finally, chapters 22 through 31, just Eliphaz and Bildad, Zophar is silent because he's got nothing more to say. And essentially, that last part, 22 through 31, is mostly Job talking. Mostly his response, and it is intense. You can easily say when you read the book of Job, by the time we get to these chapters, Job is essentially saying, would you all just shut up? And he just goes at them. I mean, he says very harsh things, accurate things to them. Because they never did better than the 7 days they sat quietly. They never did better than that. And this is what it is. And there's many different arguments, and each has their own little take on the situation. But essentially, in chapter 4 through 31, they're all saying essentially the same thing. Job, we all agree that God is wise and just and loving. And we also understand that God's wisdom has ordered the universe in a generally fair and just way. That is, if you're diligent, you'll be made fat. And if you are lazy, you'll come to ruin. If you're gracious, grace will be extended to you. If you're violent, violence will return to you. We all know this, Job. So something must be up with you. I mean, listen to some of their wisdom. Sometimes I think we don't really pay attention when we read the book of Job. Listen to their wisdom. Eliphaz says this in chapter 4 and 5. Remember now whoever perished being innocent. Or where were the upright cut off? Even as I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. Can a mortal man be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his maker? Wrath kills a foolish man, and envy slays a simple one. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble spring from the ground. Everything he said is supported in the scripture, in Proverbs. It's true. Bildad said this, does God subvert judgment or does the Almighty pervert justice? Behold, God will not cast away the blameless, nor will he uphold the evildoers. Is that not true? Zophar says this, can you search the deep things of God? Can you find out the limits of the Almighty? That's a very good statement. I mean, their wisdom sounds like the Proverbs of Solomon. I only quoted you brief portions, but this is the gist of their foundation. But yet, if we were to fast forward to the end of the book, we discover that God rebukes these three men for their words. Job 42:7, and so it was, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends. My wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. So were they right or were they wrong? Because they spoke God's word, but God rebukes them. What's going on? How can God rebuke these friends for saying generally true things that God himself has said? There is an issue here. There's three massive mistakes they made. Massive. In other words, they weren't all wrong, but these three mistakes they made were big. The first one, general truths about God's wisdom and ordering in the universe is God's intended purpose, but not necessarily the way things work in a cursed world. In other words, they devalued or misunderstood the extent of a sin-cursed world. They wanted to live in Eden in the desert. They wanted heaven's principles to be true under the sun. And they're not always true. The wisdom of Proverbs gives us general truths that reveal to us God's intention for the universe, but not necessarily how it's all going to happen. Not in a life lived under the curse of Satan. Second, they had no understanding of mercy. To them, you get what you deserve. Thus, Job must be getting what he deserved. If he would just be honest with himself, they could just move on because God would then bless him. Zophar says this in chapter 11, if you would prepare your heart and stretch out your hands toward him, if iniquity were in your hands, you put it far away and would not let the wickedness dwell in your tents, then surely you could lift up your face without spot. You could be steadfast and not fear. If you just confess your sin, Job, that's all you got to do. God will take away all this bad stuff if you just tell him all the things you've done wrong. Had no sense of mercy, because the problem with banking everything on a you get what you deserve paradigm is that if that were the only truth operative in God's universe, none of us would make it past our toddler years. There must be a principle of mercy that God has upon us. Otherwise, we could not last birth. And they completely ignored the concept of mercy in a cursed world. But thirdly, and most importantly, the biggest, they assumed God's role as wise judges. They assumed God's role as wise judges. Job himself alludes to this arrogance in one of his responses. He says, "No doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you." Eliphaz, the Temanite, had the audacity at one point to speak as the all-wise judge concerning Job. He says, "Is not your wickedness great and your iniquity without end? For you have taken the pledges from your brother for no reason and stripped the naked of their clothing. You have not given the weary water to drink, and you have withheld bread from the hungry." Eliphaz actually thought that he could see into Job's heart and determine what he'd done and not done. We know that wasn't any true. Like, Eliphaz is not saying anything true there, because God says that Job was upright. But he's just throwing out now assumptions. I'm the judge, and I'm going to judge what you've done. They took God's place of judgment. Now, Job was not sinless. He did better than most would, certainly, and better than his friends, for sure. He understood that life in a cursed world brings what often appears to be random suffering, that the rules don't always work, and that's why he defends himself. He essentially replies constantly through chapter 3 on, of chapter 4 on, "I know I'm not perfect, but I'm not getting what I deserved." I know that. Either way, good or bad, it's not, I know that. Job expresses throughout the book that he has a keen understanding of God's mercy, and he had hope, not in his works or efforts. Indeed, work and justice, you get what you deserve, that's learned naturally in our world. Mercy and grace, they're learned supernaturally. Job's faith relationship with God had taught him that sovereign mercy is God's principal way of working with us in this cursed world. And so Job says in a moment of clarity, expressing his hope in God's mercy, "For I know that my Redeemer lives, and that he shall stand at last on the earth. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold and no other. How my heart yearns within me." He believed in mercy, a God of mercy. Famously, Job said in chapter 1, "The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord, merciful God." Chapter 23, he says, "He knows the way that I take, and when he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold." The friends were wrong. Not about the idea that God is a just God, but they were wrong about misunderstanding curse, ignoring mercy, and thinking they had the right to become the judges that God is. Job was right that suffering and pain are unpredictable in a world cursed by sin. He was right about that, and they were wrong. And he was right that God now operates on the basis of mercy under the sun while we are yet in the flesh. But Job had had enough, and he gets to the end of his conflict with his miserable comforters, as he calls them. He turns his frustration toward God, and he actually has the audacity to demand that God answer him. "Why me?" 31:35, Job says, "Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book for me." This then breaks in chapter 31 when he demands an answer from God. This breaks in the story. Job's three friends say nothing more. And a fourth person emerges, somebody that's been there all along, but we knew nothing about until chapter 32. This young man named Elihu. Who in the world is Elihu? He comes out of nowhere and he says, "I'm going to answer now. I've kept my silence because I'm young And the aged had wisdom, but he essentially says, but I guess the aged don't have as much wisdom as I thought. So hear my answer. And this is what Elihu essentially says. He essentially says, friends, you're wrong. Or sorry, friends, you're right. And you're wrong. Job, you're right. And you're wrong. And so there's a big debate over who this Elihu character is among scholars. And the biggest debate is he good or bad? I mean, what do you do with someone who's basically saying both? Some take the tact that he's just like Job's friends. Some take a tact that he's some kind of incarnate Christ figure, which I think is rather extreme and ridiculous. I don't believe that Elihu was wrong for two particular reasons. One, when God is angry at Job's three friends, he's not angry at Elihu. That should be a big clue for us of what he thinks of Elihu. And second, because Elihu says something that no one has said yes, that is echoed in the New Testament passages about suffering. Elihu essentially says this, Job's friends say there's a reason for your suffering, God is just, so it's your fault. Job says, there's no reason for my suffering, God is just and merciful, it's not my fault. Elihu says, who doesn't have the ultimate word, God comes with the ultimate word, but Elihu says, you're both right, you're both wrong, yes, God is just, and yes, God is merciful, it may or may not be Job's fault, but God always does have sovereign wisdom. God always has sovereign wisdom and purpose in our suffering. That's what Elihu's main point is. We don't know, but God has purpose here. Job, it's not meaningless. Friends, it's not his fault. God has purpose. Stop accusing Job. Friends, stop accusing God, Job. That's what Elihu essentially does. In 33, 12 through 26, Elihu says God's ultimate purpose in any suffering is essentially this, to keep man from going down to the pit. So he essentially is saying this, evil men, evil angels, evil circumstances mean our suffering for bad, but God means our suffering for good. Chiefly, Elihu will say, to turn ourselves from ourselves so that we don't go down the way of the wicked to the pit, to hell. That God's ultimate purpose in suffering is a spiritual one. It's not necessarily to punish us, nor is it necessarily meaningless. But our suffering and pain has God's purpose in drawing us near to him so that we might be like him. Never is one nearer to God's heart and more like Christ than in their sufferings. See, God understands suffering in a way we never will, in a way far beyond us. And God intends, as another ancient individual, Joseph, said, man, others, Satan intends it for evil. God means it for good, to draw us near to him. Well, Elihu has a good word, but not the ultimate word. He still can't answer why. Finally, chapters 38 through 41, God answers Job. So what he've been waiting for, right? Chapter 38 says, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Prepare yourself like a man. I will question and you shall answer me. See, Job just said, God, answer me. And God says, no, Job, answer me. Answer me. I don't believe God is angry at Job. He never rebukes Job for his complaints, his heartache, or even his despairing of life. But God does make it crystal clear who needs to answer to whom in this life and the life to come. And that's an important point. Now, the record of God's answer to Job is an amazing scientific display of God's beautiful, good, and wise hand in creating and sustaining the universe. He essentially takes Job on a tour of his cosmos. This amazingly complex universe, stopping along the way to show him botany and zoology and astronomy and other amazing things. He talks about weather patterns, birds, and migratory habits. He talks about the miracle of life and animal kingdom and so on. And he does so in a rhetorical way, calling upon Job to answer him how all this works. And most importantly, how a God like him, who could do all of this and run this amazingly complex universe, how that sort of God who created order in all these things is somehow distant and impotent and out of touch with Job's pain. From time to time, Job seems to proverbially curl up into a ball. Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Twice I will not proceed any further. But God isn't finished. In chapter 40, he challenges Job to take on God's responsibility as perfect judge. To be a judge filled with ultimate glory and infinite wisdom for just one moment. Have you an arm like God? Or can you thunder with a voice like his? Then adorn yourself with majesty and splendor and array yourself with glory and beauty. Disperse the rage of your wrath. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. Job, do what I do, and then tell me what you think about it. And then in almost a very, very unique way, he concludes his words to Job by introducing him to two giant beasts. He calls them Behemoth and Leviathan. And I have no idea what Behemoth and Leviathan are. They appear to be some sort of massive creature, I believe dinosaur-like creatures. He introduces them to him, and he essentially says this: look at Behemoth, and look at Leviathan, massive, fire-breathing, snorting, strong beasts that no man can tame, and no man can do anything. And Job, in a given a moment, those beasts would crush you and think nothing of it. But I made them. I control them. They're mine. Do you not trust my hand that crushes you? Here's the implication. God's power and wisdom is unmatched in the universe. Job, God is not impotent in your suffering, nor is he silent. He is wise and he is good. Trust his powerfully good hand, even in your pain. Chapter 42. After this confrontation with God in the storm, Job says, I have heard you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now, Job says something curious there. He says, I've heard of you, but now my eye sees you. But he never actually saw God in a physical form. It says that God appeared to him in the massive storm, right? The whirlwind. And then God put on display creation, and he put on display Behemoth and Leviathan. He never actually saw him, but Job seems to say, now I've seen you. Essentially, Job is saying, you've revealed yourself to me through everything you've made and done. God now rebukes Job's three friends and tells them that Job will pray for them. How's that for irony? He tells them, I rebuke you, and don't worry, my servant Job will pray for you, and I will accept his sacrifice on your behalf. And he tells them this, and it says that his friends were humbled, that God did forgive them on Job's behalf. And the story ends as abruptly as it began. And it does say God gave Job twice as much as he had when he had lost it, except for his children. It says the same amount he gave them, perhaps because his deceased children, some have thought, lived on with the Lord. Already was twice as many of them, perhaps. Or perhaps simply because everything that Job had been given in the first place was due to God's mercy, and everything he was given in the second place was due to God's mercy. He didn't earn it through the suffering. He didn't prove himself faithful, and thus God blessed him with rewarding him with good stuff. Job did not sin in an egregious way like his friends, but you can't read the book of Job and think that he comes out without any fault. So God didn't reward him. He said, yeah, you did it. You passed the test. It wasn't a test in the first place. God simply was merciful. And he chose to give Job things. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And that's it. The story ends. The story ends this way. And Job died being old and full of days. That's the way the whole thing ends. And when we're left with this huge gaping hole, something's missing. You know what's missing, right? God never answered Job's question, why? He never answered that. You see, it didn't come to the end, and God says, no, Job, I know you're all upset. You have every right to be upset, but I just want to tell you. You see, Satan, he came to me. He was attacking you. I defended you. And so all of this suffering, it was all Satan. He did it. It was so that I could prove to him and to others that you're a good and upright man. See, Job, there's so much going on that you didn't understand, but let me just tell you all that was happening. He doesn't. Job never finds out about the unseen world. He never knows why. And God doesn't see the need to tell him why. You know why God doesn't tell Job why? He doesn't give him the answers. Why me? Because God gives Job something far better than why. God gives Job himself. Many of you know who Johnny Erickson Tada is, a dear Christian woman who was paralyzed in a diving accident 52 years ago and now a quadriplegic. 18 years old, she became a quadriplegic. She has suffered greatly in her life, but has given herself to ministering the gospel to sufferers. She's written over 40 books. She once said, God is good, not because he gives us answers, but because he gives us himself. This is precisely the point of Job. When Job demands an answer of why, God does better. He gives Job himself. He doesn't tell him why he is suffering, but he says, look and see who I am. I'm with you. He tells him who. See my wisdom, see my goodness, see my sovereign power, see my mercy. So Job sees God and repents. Most of us will not suffer quantitatively as Job has, but we will all suffer qualitatively as Job did in many ways and to varying degrees. What will we hold on to in our sufferings? What will we hold on to in our pain? What will we learn from Job? Three quick closing comments. Suffering is real and it hurts deeply. That's what we learned first in Job. It's okay to cry out in pain, to feel the weight of this cursed world. We must not be as those who pretend that suffering is itself a sin or a lack of faith or such nonsense, and nor must we be like Job's friends, miserable comforters. Suffering is real. Two, God has purpose in our pain via Elihu's words. It's a spiritual purpose. It's a glorifying and conforming us to the image of God. But three, God is so good and wise over his immeasurably complex cosmos, and his wisdom does not cease in our pain. And so he has given us himself, which is far better than a forgettable temporal answer, why? He's given us himself. He gives us himself in general revelation of creation. We see the world and we see God's goodness and sovereignty and power. This is why the Puritans practiced going out for walks in nature. This is why we don't do suffering sometimes well. And this isn't complete, but we don't do suffering well sometimes because we just kind of cloister ourselves. What we need to do is go on a tour. We need to see God's work, his wisdom, his power. See his handiwork and be drawn to him. He's revealed himself. He's given himself in creation. He's given himself in special revelation. He's given himself in the Bible. When you are in the depths of pain, see God, know God, pick up your letters from home and read about God's mercy that endures to all generation. His wisdom, his sovereignty, his grace, his justice, his righteousness, his compassion. He gives himself to us in his letters, his book, and he says, know me. See that I am God. Quiet your soul before the powerful voice of God. And ultimately, he gives himself in Jesus Christ. For thousands of years, humanity has suffered under the weight of a sin-cursed world. I am very thankful that God did not shout down from heaven, just keep going, just try hard. There's purpose. No, he actually, God himself, he left his glory in heaven. He came down to earth. He sat on the ground with us. He put sackcloth and ashes on his head. And he said, I'm going to take your sin that brings suffering. I'm going to take it all. And I'm going to take it on myself and I'm going to nail it to a cross. He gave us himself. God loved the world in this way. He gave his only begotten Son. Whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. And he has promised he'll come back. After he conquered sin and redemption, he said, I'll come back. And where I'm taking you when I come back, there will be no more death, dying, weeping, for the former things are passed away. Suffering only ends in Jesus. The revelation of God, God giving himself to us. What do we do with our suffering? We weep. We mourn, we long for heaven, but most of all, beloved, we lean into Christ. We lean into Christ's word. We embrace knowing him above all. We trust his sovereign wisdom and skill, his love and mercy, even when we don't know why. We may settle ourselves and that we can know who. We can know who is all powerful, who is all wise, who is all good, and who is with us. Because God has given us himself to know him, to love him, to serve him.